This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins in for Anthony Brooks. Today marks the start of the second week of jury selection in the trial of accused Boston Marathon bomber Johar Tsarnaev. Later this week, the judge, the prosecutors, and defense attorneys are all expected to question prospective members of the jury. They'll ask about jurors' backgrounds, their feelings about the death penalty, and whether they already have an opinion about Tsarnaev's guilt or innocence. This trial is expected to take 4 months, and legal experts are looking at what arguments the defense may make to avoid Tsarnaev's conviction and potentially have him facing the death penalty. Forensic psychiatrist Judith Edersheim says that brain science is likely to play a role in this trial. Courts are increasingly looking at what neuroscience tells us about adolescence and the developing brain. Judith Edersheim is co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital's Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior. She writes about the Tsarnaev case on WBUR's Common Health blog. Hello, Judith.
Hi.
Thanks a lot for coming in. And listeners, we want to hear your questions about this issue of young developing brains, how they impact behavior, criminal or otherwise. And we want to know what you want to know about the research around neuroscience and behavior, especially the behavior of adolescents who are charged in heinous crimes. Pose your questions or state your comments at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Judith, Johar Tsarnaev was 19 years old when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. Can we really think of him for these purposes as an adolescent?
Well, it's an interesting point. 19 in common parlance is thought to be emerging into adulthood. But really, all of the new neuroscience shows that the brain is very plastic and its plasticity lasts for much longer than we thought in the past. So really from the ages of 13 to the early 20s and sometimes even beyond, the brain is still developing and it can be considered an adolescent brain.
Until roughly what age?
Until about the age of 23, 22, early 20s. And there are some faculties that still develop in women and men in their 30s and 40s.
So how would that figure into this trial potentially?
Well, I can speculate because I'm not involved in the inside of this trial, of course. I know what has been presented in the media, so I have some pretty educated guesses about what's likely. The neuroscience in this context is going to take center stage really at the penalty phase of these proceedings.
This is if Johar Tsarnaev is indeed convicted.
Yes. Death penalty cases have a guilt and innocence phase, and then they have a penalty phase. And the penalty phase is really a mini trial. And the goal is to show the defendant in his whole personhood. What makes this defendant tick? How does he function under what strains and under what circumstances was the crime committed? And the defense will fully expose this defendant to attempt to show that he's perhaps less blameworthy than others think or less culpable than is required for someone to receive the death penalty.
But what did they use for evidence? Because as far as we know, there's been no brain scan of Johar Tsarnaev and none is expected to be done. So what are they using for evidence?
Well, it's an interesting point. Neuroscience evidence will have an uphill climb in the penalty phase. I'm fairly certain it will be admitted, not because it is directly on point, but because the evidentiary rules in the penalty phase are relaxed. The deck is stacked in favor of the defendant, and everything should come in, because otherwise you risk reversal on appeal. The Supreme Court has said that everything that pertains to a defendant's character, the circumstances of the crime, his upbringing, his psychological makeup, all of that comes in. And included under that rubric will be neuroscience evidence about adolescent brains.
Okay. There is one person who we can talk to as well who knows a lot about this and can tell us about this perspective on the court case. This is Lauren Steinberg, who's a psychology professor at Temple University and author of the book Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Steinberg.
Sure, thanks.
Okay, there's no way, as Dr. Edersheim has said, to know exactly what's going on in Johar Tsarnaev's brain. But in general, what does the current research tell us about brain development around the age of 19?
Well, I think that current research would say that the brain is still developing at that age, that in some but not all respects, people that age, on average, and that's very important, on average are less mature than people who are in their mid to late 20s, I think the key questions are going to concern what aspects of brain development are relevant here, because some aspects of the brain reach adult maturity by the time people are 15 or 16, and others take much longer. So I think you need to tie the science to the particular legal question that's asked. I also think that, you know, there are two separate questions here. One is whether the defense is going to introduce neuroscience evidence to try to make the case. The other is how compelling it will be. I'm skeptical that it will be very compelling, and I say that for a couple of reasons. The first is that the way in which neuroscience has influenced discussions about adolescent culpability thus far have concerned where we draw boundaries between adolescents and adults under the law. That was the issue, really, in the Supreme Court cases that people have been talking about in this context. And it is much more difficult to talk about brain science in relation to an individual's behavior than it is to talk about averages of people from different age groups.
But is there nothing to be gleaned by looking at the brain science in aggregate of adolescents?
Well, there is if what you're going to try to be deciding is how to treat people in the aggregate. But there's a lot of variability among people the same age, and it's not clear that because 19-year-olds on average are less mature than adults, that this 19-year-old is less mature than an adult. So I think that going from the group to the individual is very, very tricky. I think the other important point to make here is that, you know, the Supreme Court cases in which neuroscience played a role were not argued in front of juries. They were argued in front of the Supreme Court, and they were not really about individuals. They were about the law. And I think this makes this case very, very different.
In those cases, Dr. Edersheim, the cases that were argued before the Supreme Court, would you say that the neuroscience was extremely persuasive to the court itself?
Well, Dr. Steinberg has written extensively on this, and his writings are wonderful. It appeared that the Supreme Court evolved much the way the neuroscience evolved. So if you look at the earliest case, Roper, the only mention of the neuroscience was in the oral arguments, I believe.
What is that case?
That was Roper v. Simmons, the case that held that juveniles can't be executed, that it is unconstitutional to execute someone who was a juvenile when he committed the crime or she committed the crime. So the case evolved through a series of cases until Miller versus Alabama, in which the court explicitly relied on neuroscience evidence. And in that case, I would say the reliance was heavy, but it wasn't exclusive. This is very important. I think that let's not forget that there is a mountain of psychological evidence demonstrating that adolescents are different from grown-ups. Any parent of a teenager knows that an adolescent is less mature, makes erratic decisions in some cases, sometimes executes poor judgment, responds to peer pressure, all of those important things. The neuroscience was confirmatory in that case, but there was always evidence from psychology that adolescents behaved differently. So the reliance was explicit in the last case, Miller versus Alabama, but it wasn't exclusive, and the same will be true of this trial.
Why did you, Dr. Steinberg, make the distinction between this case, the case that you referred to that was argued before the Supreme Court versus before a jury? Are jurors considered more vulnerable to evidence presented as part of neuroscience in cases?
No, not so much that. I think that jurors are going to be more vulnerable to the details, you know, of the crime. And I think that in my experience, that when you get to the point that the offense that's being discussed is a very heinous one, that people, they really don't care, about the brain science. I don't think it's going to be very persuasive given the nature of this particular crime. The other point that I would make, and I agree with Dr. Edersheim completely about this, about the behavioral evidence being also very important, in fact, maybe even more important, is that it seems to me that the best argument that the defense could make here is that we're talking about a 19-year-old who may have been coerced or at least heavily influenced by an older and more powerful individual. We know that people this age are susceptible to the influence of other peers, particularly older peers, but that's an aspect of adolescent development where there is not a great deal of relevant brain science. So I think in this instance, it may be the behavioral science that's more compelling than the neuroscience.
Dr. Edersheim, if you can talk about a particular case here of a younger person seeming to be under the influence somewhat of an older person's ideology, and this is the case of the sniper attacks in the Washington, D.C. area in 2002.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, do you remember that case?
Sure. That was a very high-profile case where an older individual, I believe his name was John Muhammad.
John Muhammad, exactly right. And the younger was Lee Malvo.
Lee
we should
Malvo.
Say, just to fill in some of the blanks, Lee Malvo was 17 at the time of the shootings. Muhammad was much older.
There are some interesting parallels about those cases. So the D.C. sniper case involved the older influential male, John Allen Muhammad, allegedly influencing a much younger individual, someone whom he had met when he was in his mid-teens, as I recall. And the case was made at trial very similar to this, that an older dominant male, a pseudo-father figure, because that was the role that I think Muhammad held with respect to Malvo, had great influence over him and manipulated him into being his accomplice in committing these crimes. In that sense, there would be a parallel that an older, at least if what the press reports about the relationship is true, I'm sure that the defense team here will develop a theme. And the theme is clear, that an older, dominant Tamerlan Tsarnaev, probably 6 or 7 years older, was a father figure, particularly after the Tsarnaev parents left the country and were divorced, that vacuum was filled by the older brother and that he really engineered and manipulated this young person.
And Tamerlan is the older brother who died in a shootout with police. So how does the neuroscience figure into that?
Well, I agree with Dr. Steinberg. There are so many problems with introducing group evidence to weigh on the behavior of one individual. I think it will be a backdrop. I think the theme will be, look how vulnerable adolescents are. They're suggestible. They take risks. They are very vulnerable to peer pressure, and their judgment isn't as well developed as other people. And that will be the backdrop for a story about Johar Tsarnaev, that he was under the sway of a dominant and reputed to be aggressive or violent older brother, that his choices were limited. Statutory mitigators like being under extreme emotional disturbance or duress, they will try to prove those themes in order to make the case that that the younger Tsarnaev was less culpable, less blameworthy, and thus not deserving of the death penalty.
Okay, let's take a question now from some of our listeners. On line one, we have Steve, who is calling in from Cambridge. Hello, Steve.
Hello. I have two reservations about what's being discussed today. The first is that scientists and researchers are often overplay the certitude of their research and its importance in courts. This is not just neuroscientists, but psychologists and many others. That's my first objection. The second is this idea that someone's brain is supposedly less developed not only can resolve him or her of let's say, some responsibility, but can also be used to say, oh, you can't make your own decisions because your brain isn't formed enough. We have to make them for you. So I worry about that.
We have to make them for you, the decisions for you, or we have to protect you from the decisions that you may have made on your own. Thank you very much, Steve. Good points. Let's find out what our guests have to say about that. First, Dr. Steinberg.
Well, as to the first, I mean, I think one can look at the Supreme Court rulings and opinions and see that neuroscience certainly did play a role, particularly in Miller, as Dr. Edersheim pointed out. So whether we think it ought to is a different question than whether it does, and it clearly is playing a role in legal decisions. As to whether Describing adolescents as less mature than adults can be, in some senses, I gather the caller's question really is whether this can be used against them in some way. I think it's very important, again, to link the specific legal question with the specific science. So on matters that involve logical reasoning abilities, for example, adolescents perform as well as adults. So if the legal question has to do with whether an adolescent is capable of making a logical decision, then I think the science doesn't take away adolescents' rights or disfavor them in some way. So I really think it, I think you have to look at the particular legal question and ask how the science is used and how it might be misused.
Judith Edersheim.
You know, I agree with Dr. Steinberg, and I generally agree with the caller. It's very important not to overstate what we know about science in the legal context, and particularly in the context of one case. So both Dr. Steinberg and I have, and not coincidentally, been making the point that what the defense will have to do is link the science to a relevant mental state. What is this defendant or any defendant accused of, and can you make an inference from brain to behavior? When you're trying to make that inference, the behavior better go along with the brain picture. So if you are going to say that a defendant is immature and impulsive, then planning and premeditation and careful contemplation for any defendant would fly in the face of that. So one benefit to having sensible juries and sensible judges is that they will examine the behavioral evidence, and to the extent that the behavioral evidence trumps the brain scan, behavior is going to win.
Final question, very briefly. If it's determined that Johar Tsarnaev is guilty, and if it's determined part of the reason that he might be guilty is because his behavior was the result of having basically an adolescent brain or an underdeveloped brain at this point, as is the case, would be consistent with his age, what happens then in the punishment segment of the trial? Should someone who is deemed young and therefore having less kind of discretion over their behavior be subject to capital punishment at that point, since juveniles are not able to be executed under current law?
Well, it's an interesting, very interesting point. So technically, a 19-year-old is not a juvenile when he commits the crime for legal purposes. So,
but his brain may be underdeveloped.
His brain may be underdeveloped or overdeveloped, so to speak.
And we should say this is all if the trial does show guilt in the end.
Yes, absolutely. You're presuming innocence, and the trial is the last great drama in our experience, and so one doesn't know what's going to be presented. But you don't get to the penalty phase unless a guilty verdict has been entered. That said, juvenile brain evidence is going to be a double-edged sword. So calling someone immature and impulsive and perhaps volatile and having poor judgment may convince a jury that they should be locked up forever. And it also may convince a jury that perhaps the death penalty is warranted. I think it's very important to say about adolescents that one of the most important reasons why the Supreme Court felt they should be treated differently is that their brains are plastic, that they have the potential for rehabilitation. So the defense will emphasize that this is a young man who has the potential for rehabilitation. And that's what distinguishes adolescents from much older people whose character and trajectories are, for the most part, fixed.
Okay. Final word from you, briefly, Dr. Steinberg.
I agree completely. I think that the issue is going to be both one of rehabilitation, that is the plasticity question, and one of culpability, because I think the Supreme Court's rationale in Roper and those other cases is that we should reserve the worst of all of our penalties for the people who are most responsible for the worst crimes. And if the defense can persuade the jury that Jokar is less than fully responsible for his actions because he was coerced into them, then I think that they have a good argument to make.
Thank you. Both Lawrence Steinberg, psychology professor at Temple University, author of the book Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence, and Judith Edersheim, co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital's Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior. She writes about the Tsarnaev case on WBUR's Common Health blog, which you can find a link to at WBUR.org. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Radio Boston.